everybody. Sorry for the delay. Looks like we had some problems with the lines, and that's not surprising considering the weather around the world and the fact that we're connecting over the Atlantic. So thanks for waiting, and hope you've hung in there, because we've got a great show tonight, as always. So before I introduce my guest, I just want to inform you that the Peru trip is really filling up fast. We've only got 14 places left. Please make a decision soon, and remember that you need to get to the sacred sites on this planet, whether it's with me or with anyone else. Now is the time for you to move, to pick up those codes, to bring the love into those vortices and energize this planet. And I've also got a trip coming up to the crop circles in July. That's on my website now, too. So take a look, www.syrianrevelations.net. And that one has only got 25 places, and only 20 are left. So think about that, too. I hope to have you with me. Okay, that's enough promotion. Let's get on and introduce my fascinating guest. Courtney Roberts is her name. She's a truly academic astrologer, historian. She has a number of really titillating books out there introducing the astrological dimension into comparative religious and historical studies. So she's a perfect candidate for Beyond the Matrix of the Dogma. Courtney Roberts, she's a master of arts. She's a writer, a teacher, a consultant. She is a very, very wise lady. Thank you for being with me tonight, Courtney.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. And tonight we'll be talking about your book, The Star of the Magi, The Mystery That Heralded the Coming of Christ. Okay, here we go. This book blows my mind because it's very deep. It's very profound. And it definitely blows open the confines of the historical implication and interpretation. So I'd like to start by asking you, first of all, what was your inspiration for writing this book?
Well, that's a fair enough question. Of course, my fundamental inspiration would be the Star of Bethlehem itself. I think that's something that has inspired people from all different persuasions all around the world for several thousand years now. And that was a starting point. I actually began the book as a research paper I did when I was doing my master's degree at Bath Spa in England, and we were doing a module on stellar religion. And I was very interested in the whole idea of what kind of a role did ancient astrology play in the earliest Christian communities. We've got such tantalizing traces of stellar religion throughout early Christianity, but, you know, a lot of it's been rubbed out and edited out over the years. So I really wanted to pursue that. And, of course, if you start pursuing that, right away you come up against the star and all the different interpretations of it. And the more I looked into it and the more I really tried to grapple with who the Magi were and what kind of astrology they practiced, I realized there was really something to it, and also that this whole idea of the Magi's religion and the Magi's astrology was something that nobody had ever really factored into all the 2,000 years worth of studies on the star, which in itself was, you know, really surprising. So that's how this whole journey started, and I ended up turning part of that research paper into this book.
I'm glad we are that you did. So are you going to tell us, of course, to ask you to synopsize such very intense study into very few words is a little bit limiting, but I would like to ask you, for starters, so according to you and to the book, who were the Magi?
Well, you know, you don't have to take my word on it. We actually have a lot of historical evidence for who they were and for what they believed, and also for the very important role that they played in the spread of messianic expectations throughout the ancient world at the time of Christ. Now, they were a Persian priesthood, a hereditary priestly caste or order, and they originally started amongst the Medes of ancient Media. Now, that would be the southern shores of the Caspian Sea. It's now part of Iraq and Iran. In fact, we tend to call it Kurdistan. It's a Kurdish area now. So that's where they originally came from. But after the 6th century BC, they were very much identified as the priesthood of the Persian royal house, and is representing the official religion of the Persian Empire, which we've come to know as Zoroastrianism today. But, you know, this is 2,500 years ago, so, you know, the religion has changed and grown a lot in the interim. But they were there in the early days of Zoroastrianism. And they were also, because they were so associated with Persian royalty and the Persian Empire, the Magi had a very powerful position in Babylon. And Babylon was where the Chaldeans were, and they were the famous stargazers. And the Magi had alliances with the Chaldeans going, you know, way back to 7th, 8th century BC. So the Magi were known with the Chaldeans as being the crack astrologers and astronomers of the ancient world. And that's how they appear.
And you talk in the book about their long-standing astrological traditions about a coming world savior, a fact that there would be three world saviors, and one who would precipitate the apocalypse.
Yes, and
so,
all of
that. Go ahead. We've got a little bit of a tinny sound.
Yeah, all of that is very relevant to their appearance in the Gospel of Matthew. It's very relevant to why the author of Matthew thought it would be a good idea to put these fellows in there looking for Christ. The Magi had a very unique kind of religious astrology, and as part of their religious astrology, they were expecting these world saviors, these messiahs, to come at very regular astrological intervals. And that would have been pretty well known throughout the ancient world at the time of Christ. It's something that we have forgotten over the years. So when we see the Magi now in Matthew's Gospel, it doesn't seem to make any sense. But, you know, to people at the time, the kind of people that Matthew was writing to, it would have made perfect sense.
Well, most of us are probably not as well-versed as you are in those passages. So bear with us if we need a little help going back over the history.
Sure.
When you talk about that passage, exactly what are you referring to when you talk about his reference to that?
Okay, the Star of Bethlehem and the three wise men who came seeking it, it only occurs in the Gospel of Matthew. It's not in Mark, it's not in Luke, it's not in John. It's only in Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the very beginning of Matthew, which, by the way, is the first book of the New Testament. And Matthew opens with a genealogy, which is kind of typical. He wants to trace Jesus' genealogical roots back to Judah, the royal tribe of Judea. And right after he concludes the genealogy, he introduces these three magi, that's the word he uses in the original language, and he says that they came from the east following the star, seeking Jesus, and that they came into Jerusalem and confronted the rulers of Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who was born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and we have come to worship him." And that's the origin of our whole Christmas tradition of the three wise men. It's only in the Gospel of Matthew. So that's the source.
Okay, now what is your understanding of what the star is? Because I see in the book that you refer to, okay, this is complicated astrological information for people who don't know astrology, but I'd mm-hmm. like you to elaborate on your comment and that passage where you talk about the triple conjunction, or rather the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction in Pisces. Can you explain that? And are
yes.
you suggesting that this hypothesis is actually what was the Star of Bethlehem?
Well, you know, first we want to, you know, just to be scrupulous here, we want to ask the question, was there really a Star of Bethlehem? Is this just a story, or is it, you know, more than just a story? Is it a story with great, you know, symbolic or religious intent? Is it completely fictional? Is it an actual historical account? These are valid questions. These are important questions because we
some people have even said, you know, was it an extraterrestrial passing craft?
Sure.
And none of these suggestions are to be poo-pooed without at least being open to the possibilities. I'm sure you agree.
Yeah, there's been all kinds of explanations, and I think there was a great article in one of the astronomical journals back in the 90s by a theologian named Kim Hassenroth, who very insightfully said that, you know, how you ask the question, what was the Star of Bethlehem, and how you go about answering it, reveals a lot more about, you know, the person doing the asking and answering than it does about the Star of Bethlehem. You know, we all bring a lot of baggage to this question.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's important to stand back and recognize what your own limits and parameters are. And I think the Star is useful in helping us to do that. So, yeah, just going back to that basic question, you know, do we want to treat it as an historical account? Or are there other ways to look at it? We know that that little story in the Gospel of Matthew is probably one of the latest additions to that Gospel. And generally, you know, biblical scholarship seems to indicate that it was put in there maybe as late as the year 80 A.D., certainly, you know, after the destruction of Jerusalem. So it could have been a later addition. Now, I'm not by any means saying that it's just a story and that it's not historical. I think that in putting that story in there, the author of Matthew or the editors of Matthew, or whoever they were, they had a very important purpose in including that story. I think they were referring to these great astrological traditions of the Magi, and they really felt that if they could link the birth of Christ into that religious system and that religious astrology, that it really helped to make their case for the divinity of Christ. It really helped to convince their contemporary readers of their message. So even if it's not a, you know, definite historical account, even if there were, you know, no three wise men that came across the desert actually looking for him, it is a very important reference to that tradition and how important that tradition was to people at the time. So I think that's the first thing we need to bear in mind. But, you know, going back to what you'd ask about, you know, what was the star, I think, if I could just rephrase that question a little bit, I would ask, what was the astrology of the Magi, and what would the Magi have been looking for to indicate
okay,
the birth of
the
great
know.
King? Pardon me?
Well, that is really the focus of your book, isn't it?
Yeah. So the Magi had two main indicators of the coming of great prophets and new religions. The first indicator were the millenniums. The Magi believed in the millennia, that all of history was organized into these 1,000-year periods. And, you know, many people still carry this belief today, and it actually goes back to these Persian Magi. And these were astrological millennia for the Magi. Each consecutive millennium was ruled by a sign of the zodiac, and that was meaningful to them. So that was the first thing they were looking for, was this idea of astrological millennia, and, you know, the dawning of a new millennia would always be an important turning point, an important new age. So they were always on the lookout for that. Now, you can see, I think, very easily how that idea of the millennia got picked up by early Christianity and remains a big part of Christianity today, especially the apocalyptic version. So I don't think there's any argument that that's relevant in early Christianity and even today. The second astrological indicator that the Magi used was the cycle of Saturn and Jupiter conjunctions. And Saturn and Jupiter were the two biggest planets out there, and the Magi had figured out, oh, a good 500 years before Christ was born, that Saturn and Jupiter appear to meet up regularly in the sky, to come together, to make a conjunction. And they do that every 20 years, pretty much like clockwork. And each time they make a conjunction, what they're actually doing is tracing out this beautiful series of interlacing triangles through the zodiac. It's really a very compelling pattern. And this pattern of interlacing triangles moves through the circle of the zodiac, and it takes, by the Magi's calculations, it took almost exactly 1,000 years for that cycle to make a complete circuit of the zodiac. So for them, that defined a millennium, the Saturn and Jupiter conjunctions. So those are the two main indicators that they were looking at. And we do have some evidence in later texts that they believe there was a coincidence of the Saturn-Jupiter cycles and the millennium about the time of the birth of Christ or shortly thereafter, that people would have been talking about, people would have been buzzing about. You know, Matthew would have heard about it. The early Christians would have heard about it. So it was important for them to try to put the coming of Christ into that system. It really helped them to make their case.
So are you suggesting the star was a symbolic reference to that conjunction?
I would say it's beyond symbolic. It's historical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have evidence that Persian astrologers and Magi, you know, believed that the time when Christ was born was the start of a new millennium, and that his birth heralded that. And they also linked it to the birth of the Roman Empire, the rise of the Roman Empire, which is an interesting historical perspective because, you know, they were already seeing Christianity as allied with Rome. And in their astrological history, you know, this was very meaningful. The two arose at the same time. So I would say it's beyond symbolic. It is historical. Now the reason I seem to be hedging on that a little bit is, again, I'm not entirely convinced that any of these Magi astrologers were necessarily so good that they had all this figured out beforehand, before the birth of Christ. But certainly by the time the story appears in Matthew, by 80 A.D., yeah, they would have had a lot of time to think about it, and I think they would have arrived at this kind of a system. And again, that's why it's included in the gospel around about that point in history.
So what are you suggesting then, that a new star was born at the time of the birth of Christ?
No, I don't think that's necessary at all. I think by the Magi's calculations, the Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions had finished up a complete cycle in the zodiac, and they were moving back into the beginning of the fire signs, which for them meant the beginning of a new millennium, the beginning of a new age, and would signal in their system the coming of a new prophet and a new religion, and also the rise of a great world empire. And they linked the coming
right, but where do we get this light in the sky, this star?
Well, a Jupiter-Saturn conjunction is very visible. very visible.
Okay, so I'm trying to get at here is, what, in your opinion, what is this star? Is it planet conjunction? Is it a nova or a new star? Is it mythical? What is your feeling? I realize that you are an academician and there you're very objective, but I'd like to get to know your gut feeling about this.
Well, I'm trying to be as clear about it as I can. I think that the people of Matthew's time would have been very excited about the Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions and about the shift that was occurring at that time back into the fire signs. They would have seen a series of conjunctions. And this is another thing that we know from the actual textual sources that we have about the kind of astrology the Magi practiced. And that's what I'm trying to work from is, you know, the textual sources that tell us what these people actually believed. You know, they didn't so much look to any one conjunction or star. There was a series of conjunctions that showed them that the cycle was moving into a new era, a new age. And then they saw the rise of this great new world empire. They saw, you know, the coming of this great new religious figure. And it all fit. It all worked within their system. The reason we keep asking questions like, what was the star? What was the star? Is because we're operating as if the account in the Gospel of Matthew is an accurate historical account. And I'm not sure that it is. I think he's trying to communicate everything that I'm saying in very simple ways to his readers who didn't understand the math, didn't understand the astronomy, but they knew that something was going on. But as you can see, even today, even as it was then, to actually explain the astronomy to someone who's not in the field, you know, there's a lot to it, and it gets very confusing. So I think it was much easier for Matthew.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, to just say, well, there was a star, and they came following the star. I mean, and that says it all right there.
All right, well, then let's go back to what you said. We were talking about earlier that there were, they predicted three messiahs, the Magi, according to your book. And when would we be looking to, what I'm leading up to is one of those conjunctions 2012, by any chance?
It doesn't exactly fit into that cycle. Now, what we find historically is in many respects the Magi were right. And you have to understand that their way of thinking, it predates Judaism, it predates Christianity, it predates Islam. You know, we're talking about ideas that arose in the 6th century B.C. And they were Zoroastrians. They believed that their prophet Zoroaster had come and had brought them this wonderful new religion, this very dualistic religion where everybody was living in this battle against between good and evil. And it was, you know, so important to choose to be on the right side, to be on the good side. And so as part of that, they saw that all of time and history was adding up to this great battle between good and evil at the end of the world, the final apocalypse, where the forces of good would defeat evil forever, and a new millennium of peace would come in. Now, again, we've taken these ideas wholesale into not only early Christianity, but contemporary Christianity and Judaism and Islam. Islam believes the same thing. But these are not Jewish or Christian or Muslim ideas. They're Persian ideas. They came from the underlying Persian religion, and that is the underlying unifying source of all your later monotheisms. It's not recognized as such by them, because they all claim, you know, that they have divine origins, separate origins, and that they're better than each other. But this is the actual historical paradigm in which all of these ideas developed. Now, as part of this earlier Zoroastrian system, all of history is leading up to this ultimate battle, right? So their good God would, at specific intervals, send a savior, a deliverer, to spread the good religion, to spread good thought and good action, and to speed this whole, you know, process along, the process of good conquering evil. So that was the origin of this idea of coming saviors and coming messiahs. And what we actually find in the Zoroastrian literature, and particularly as it relates to the Magi, is that They saw Jesus Christ as one of these saviors, and that he brought a new religion and did much good, and spread the same religion that the Magi were practicing, but just, you know, a new improved form. They also saw Muhammad as doing exactly the same thing, as being like a Messiah, a deliverer, who spread the good religion to people who had not had it before. And they didn't see him as being, you know, all that different from the Zoroastrian religion. It was just a new, improved version. So they put these two, you know, great prophets and their two new world religions into this system and saw them as sons of Zoroaster. And then they were expecting yet a third prophet to come. And, you know, they argued about this stuff. It's not rocket science. They didn't, you know, have it hammered out and have exact agreement. You know how people are. But they saw the third prophet largely as coming at the end of the world to lead the forces of good in this final battle. And again, Christianity still believes this, and Islam believes it very vociferously. This is the doctrine of the Mahdi. You know, so we're still dealing with...
I think about every religion believes in this final battle.
Well, I don't know if every religion does, but certainly the religions that we can historically trace back to Persian Zoroastrian do, and that would be Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and of course the Baha'i faith sees itself in exactly that same vein, and the founder of the Baha'i religion, Baha'u'llah, saw himself as one of these great, you know, prophets bringing a new world religion and being, you know, carrying that process along, and that's how he's perceived by his followers, and, you know, I wouldn't argue with him. He's very much in the same tradition, the same vein, and always claimed to be. So if they're coming out of that branch, if they're coming out of that tradition, then yes, they do tend to believe in it. I wouldn't say it's a particularly Buddhist belief, but if you get into the, you know, Maitreya Buddhism, which was very influenced by the Persian religion, then yes, it did influence it there, but you have, you know, many other forms of Buddhism as well. I wouldn't say it's particularly part of the Hindu religion, which is kind of, you know, another vein. But your monotheisms that we can trace historically back to Persian religion, yes, absolutely. It's a big part
of it. And let's also say that at this moment on this planet, there's no question that there's a pervading sense that something cataclysmic, without the negativity that attached to that word, is going to happen in 2012. I think you'll agree with me on that.
Well, there certainly are a lot of people that believe that. That's largely based
on
the...
Yeah, I tell you what, let's open this
Mayan
up for questions.
Pardon me?
I'm going to open this up for questions from our listeners. So I'm going to give you all now the call-in numbers. Call in and talk to Courtney, and you've got a chance to ask her your questions. The toll-free number is 877-876-5227. That's the U.S. And toll-free for Canada, 888-815-9756. And if you forget those numbers, you can look on the bbsradio.com website to get them again. So call in, have a chance to ask Courtney what you think about what we're talking about. So let me ask you this, Courtney. What can you tell us astrologically is going on in the fatidic date of December 21st, 2012? Can you talk to us about that?
Astrologically? I can fire up the computer here in a second and tell you exactly. It's a solstice.
That would be great.
Yeah, but mind you, I'm doing, you know, Western astrology. It's a completely different system from what the Mayans were using. The Mayans, and I'm certainly not an expert on Mayan astrology or astronomy. I'm not going to claim to be, but, you know, they didn't use our Western system, and I think they were considerably more... numerological. They operated in number cycles.
But still, we are talking about some universal truths here, and I would be very curious to hear from you as to just what's going on that date in the heavens.
Okay, December 21st, 2012. You want any particular time or place?
Oh, boy, that's right.
Okay, I guess I do it. All right, on that day, we have the sun at 0 degrees Capricorn because, of course, it's at the solstice point, so that's zero Capricorn, and it's exactly sextal Neptune at zero Pisces, which isn't so bad. It's applying to square Uranus and Aries, Jupiter's in Gemini opposite Venus and Sag. This is going to be interesting. You certainly are going to have a lot of, passionate believers out there expecting something. I can honestly say, just looking at this chart, I don't see anything particularly cataclysmic about it. And, mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on Mayan astronomy, and I don't claim to be, but in their cyclical reckoning, they stopped calculating their calendar at that point because they had, reached some ending point in their way of reckoning, or God knows, maybe they were tired, it was very hard work. But I don't know that it necessarily implies that there's any great, end or cataclysm or destruction.
The Mayans didn't say there was going to be an end. They said there was going to be a shift.
A shift is a good word, and shifts are continuous.
Yeah.
Shifts are going on constantly. Yeah, and, there's all kinds
of... A huge shift.
Well, there's all kinds of religious chronologies, different religious chronologies that use time, that use astronomy to... try to organize history and develop or find meaning through that. I've studied a lot of them, and I think some of them are, maybe more meaningful than others. There, you understand there's a fair amount of controversy over interpreting the Mayan material, interpreting what exactly it was that they meant or that they were saying.
I think it's fair to say there will always be controversy about interpretation of everything.
Yeah,
because written record is also an interpretation. So we go back to prehistory, and all of the myth and all of the tradition that comes through oral tradition, and of course it's all open to interpretation. But it's very interesting that. So much attention is focused to 2012 from various points of view, and I don't think only because of the Mayan calendar.
Well, a lot of the work of John Major Jenkins has gone, towards that point, and he's developed his position somewhat off the work of some other Mayan scholars. But, at the same time, there are other people who work along the same lines that kind of come to different conclusions. Just as when you look at, Sumerian astronomy, you've got Zachariah Sitchin, and then you've got everybody else, and he's got a particular line of interpretation, and then there are, just dozens and dozens of Sumerian scholars who completely disagree with everything that he says. So I think it's important, to the extent that you can, to go back and read the material yourself, get to the primary sources, and see what it means, for you. Because throughout all of history, there's always been prophets that come up and say, this is the end times, this is the cataclysm, and, sometimes with disastrous results. And the one thing I can say, after studying thousands of years of this, is every last one of them has been wrong.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember also that we had this at the turning of the millennium. This cataclysm mentality, and we got right through it without any problem.
That's usually
what happens. But I do think that it's a time when people are really setting themselves up for 2012 and what that's going to bring. And I do also think we'll go right through that date and shake ourselves off and go, okay, we're still here now. Now what are we going to do? Because after 2012, there really isn't any expectation of a set time that things are supposed to click.
Yeah, and remember, 20 years ago, we would have been discussing the new age, and when was it going to shift into Aquarius? That was really hot, and people had all these, very highly developed, theories about it and when it would happen. And not only was there not, great consensus But, you know, what does it all mean ultimately? I mean, ultimately, as the Zoroastrian religion points out, you go out every day and you're faced with a series of choices. You can either choose the better choices or you can choose the worst choices. And if you make the best choices, you get the best results. And if you don't, well, you get results that you're probably not going to be very happy living with. And I think we're all faced with that potential cataclysm, you know, every day on a daily basis. So I think anything that helps us with that to be more responsible and live in the moment and try to make the best choices we can in every moment, you know, that's really progressive. That's really helpful. We've also got a huge contention of Christian apocalypse people who you know, really believe that the world is coming now for different reasons or rationalizations.
Well, we also have this movement of the rapture, which is that almost, I would dare say, almost looking forward to it.
Oh, absolutely. Do you know, I
the good people get saved, the bad ones burn and die and in the fires of hell kind of energy, which I really don't enjoy hearing. But, you know, we've got religion now interlaced throughout all of the political, across the board, politicians are taking up some kind of political religious position. And it's definitely very interesting seeing how this is playing out and how it relates to 2012.
Here's another point, you know, the Christians who, as you said, are very eagerly anticipating the apocalypse and eager to do anything they can to help it happen, including arming Israel to the teeth and trying to kill off all the Palestinians, which doesn't strike me as particularly a Christian idea, but this is Persian religion, 21st century style, and if you asked any of these Christians, you know, do you realize this this stuff that you're teaching is actually just recycled Persian religion, they wouldn't have a clue, but they just don't know that much about their own belief systems. And also what a lot of people don't appreciate in the West is that as many, you know, Christians as there are, you know, passionately believing this and supporting bizarre political positions in Israel to make it happen, it's just as hot throughout the Muslim world because the Muslim world comes out of the same Persian tradition. They believe in the same kind of apocalypse. They believe that it's, you know, this end of the world battle is coming soon, and it's going to be the Muslims against everybody else, just the way the Christians believe it's them against everybody else. And
well, just as it sure looks like that's what's being evoked, doesn't it?
Well, they're making it happen. They're bringing it about by the strength of their belief, and all of them, I think, are just, you know, perverting and failing to appreciate the real origin of these ideas and how, you know, really lovely and unifying they could be if we would let them. You know, they're actually preaching the same religion against each other, which is kind of ironic.
Well, it's divide and conquer, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's human nature. I think we all want to believe that we're right and anybody who's different from us is, you know, godforsaken and must be wiped out. I mean, that's just an unfortunate...
I don't think everybody feels that way. I think that there is, as much as there is a movement to fundamentalism, there is also an incredibly growing, wonderfully growing segment of the population who are understanding the oneness of all things and getting in tune with the earth and the other.
Yeah, I really wish they would organize and get our troops out of Iraq. Because unfortunately, the people that are really pushing this apocalypse, you know, they're winning at this point. And we all need to work a lot harder.
Well, bear in mind that, you know, the new government in the United States doesn't allow you to voice any of these things without going, I mean, the United States has shifted so much out of the free speech zone that it's getting more and more difficult to openly, actively move toward affecting change like we were able to do in the late 60s. I hate to date myself, but I was burning my bra back then when we were against Vietnam.
Well, are you following the Obama
campaign
right now?
World now.
Are you following the Obama campaign right now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're speaking very freely and they're motivating people very freely. Whether or not they win in November is the real issue. And whether or not...
Right, it sounds very good. My question is, we're going to have to ask ourselves who's funding Obama. Because I'm terribly suspicious of politicians. And I would say that he sounds good, it looks good, he has the right energy, the right words. But, you know, let's change it. But I want to see who's funding this man. And then
well,
I'll tell you how
I feel
about it.
I think the doubt is in. Most of his funders are actually grassroots, small donor people, and there's millions and millions of them.
I don't think so.
Million dollars in January.
Do your homework a little bit more.
Pardon me?
No, I don't think it's just small grassroots people, but I don't think I want to go into this on the air, other than to say that before you embrace, and I'm speaking to the listeners now, before you embrace an idealist, do your homework and find out what's beneath it. And, you know,
would
make me happier than to see a true people's politician.
My point. I think what they're setting up in November, you know, innocently, because I believe Obama is quite sincere and his supporters are sincere. I'll certainly be willing to give them the benefit of the doubt there, but
he certainly looks like the best option on the board.
I like Hillary too. I think they're both great candidates. I wish they'd run together because we're going to need that. Because basically, with McCain as the Republican nominee, and the Bush administration in power up through the end of the year, if they can create enough of a military crisis, if they can create enough of a sense of threat, then McCain's a shoo-in, and we're going to have four more years of the same nonsense, and it'd be the worst thing for everybody. So, you know, people in America are very free to speak. If that weren't true, then Obama wouldn't be...
Right, but Hillary didn't vote against the war.
Yeah, but she's talking troop pullout now, so... But my point is that, you know, we can talk all
hindsight is a bummer, though, isn't it? Hold on, I think we've got a caller.
I'm not so quick to judge people. I don't want to, you know, just judge people and trash them.
Well, we have to have a judgment about the people we're going to vote for. Hold on, do we have a caller? Well, I guess not. We've got some feedback. It's not a matter of a judgment call. It's a matter of looking at the facts, okay? And it's not like saying she's a bad person because, but the facts are she did vote absolutely for the invasion of Iraq, because that's what it was. So, that's something worth noting.
Yeah, and again, if the Republicans can make enough of a military threat and a military crisis between now and November, they're going to win. And they can beat either Obama or Clinton as long as they put enough fear and intimidation into people's minds. Then they'll feel like they have to vote for John McCain. And I'm not knocking John McCain. I think he's genuinely a good person. But it's a difficult situation. And once you can...
Well, I just think that we've managed to leave the Zoroastrians and move into politics.
But it's all chronology. It's all religious chronology.
Yeah.
You know, you've got these competing world systems and these competing world views, and there is this sense that we've got huge problems facing us, especially with the environment and the planet. And if we don't get really serious about making the right choices every day and making the better choices and getting the better results every day, then, you know, we could be leading up to a global cataclysm, to an energy cataclysm, to a cataclysm in warfare. So, you know, we do need to be talking about this, and it's affecting us.
Right, but what we need to remember, and I would like to just suggest this, that it all looks very good, the words sound good, but in the end, we really have very similar people running for the President of the United States, and we have a system that puts in very similar doctrines, because the lobbyists that lobby in Washington, lobby both sides, lobby all the candidates, and that's mostly how they get their funding. So we need to be objective about what we're hearing, and I'm bringing this up because it's coming up. People are faced with these decisions. It's not about how good you look. It's not about how good you sound. It's about track record. It's about credible behavior for the voting people.
I agree.
Would you believe we're out of time?
Pardon me?
Would you believe we're already out of time?
Are you serious? Well, it is almost top of the hour. My goodness.
Well, we started late, and we've become very passionate about what we're speaking about, but I just looked at the clock and thought, oh, that was fast.
Well,
so before we sign out...
fascinating times.
Yeah, definitely, and your book helps us explore the foundation of where we are today and all the wisdom that has brought us to this point. So before we close, I want to remind people that this wonderful guest with me tonight is Courtney Roberts. Her book is The Star of the Magi, The Mystery That Heralded the Coming of Christ. I want you to know that I'm not all the way through this book. It's heavy reading. It requires, it's very intellectual, brilliant work. It requires concentration and dedication, and I assure you that I look forward to, I'm halfway now. And maybe I can talk to you again when I get to the end.
Well, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me on, and I hope everybody gets out there and, you know, rolls up their sleeves and really starts tackling the serious problems we face, because ultimately the future is as good as we make it.
I will agree to that. The book, again, The Star of the Magi, you can get it on Courtney's site. Let me see. You want to tell us the name of the site, Courtney?
Yes, it's www.CourtneyRobertsHolm.com, and I also have another site, thestarofthemagi.com, and Magi is M-A-G-I, so thestarofthemagi.com.
And do you also do astrological consultation?
Yes, I do, and they can find information
on that. Okay, gang, you might want to keep that in mind, so people, like, through your site, they can arrange to have a consultation with you?
Yes, I've got a page on each site for consultations and readings.
Well, I'll probably do that.
Great. I look forward to it.
Okay, it's been wonderful having Courtney on. Thank you all for listening in. Sorry again about the late hour, but it happens. We've just got these satellites or whatever... Whatever's connecting us all by our phones, and sometimes they're just struggling with the weather. So thank you for your patience, and I will see you next week. Beyond the Matrix, for people who think outside of the box of conventional thought. Thanks, Courtney. I hope you'll be back.
Thank you very much.
And keep doing your great work.
Thank you. I'll talk to you again soon.